The Paths to Parenthood podcast is designed to support those needing to use a donor to build their family. I'm Becky, also known as Defining Mum, and I'm also the founder of Paths to Parenthood. I'm the mum to three amazing girls, all thanks to egg donation.
And I'm Hayley King, the founder of All Things Donor Conception. I'm both a donor-conceived person and, in a twist of fate, the parent of donor-conceived children with my lovely wife.
Our aim is to open up conversations about this incredible route to parenthood, focusing on some of the nuances and complexities that it can bring.
Our hope is to provide different perspectives, information, reflection, and validation as we openly discuss different topics, share stories, and ask you for your input.
We hope you enjoy it.
Welcome back to the Paths to Parenthood podcast, and today we've got a very special episode for you. We are speaking to a recipient parent who has been on an amazing journey. I can't wait to share her story with you, and I'm very grateful to Sarah for reaching out and offering to share her story today. And we're really grateful as well that this series has been supported by OverCY Egg Bank in Cyprus, which we were very lucky to get to go and visit last year. And hey, we've had lots of different conversations, so if anyone does want to learn a little bit more about OverCY, you can listen to some of the other episodes within this series.
Yeah, that's right, Becky. I think we kicked off this series, didn't we, as just a bit of a recap and a reflections episode, actually, on our trip to Cyprus and how we found it and some of the questions and discussions that we had with the staff there. So yeah, if you are interested, definitely have a little listen back. I think that's episode one of this series. And we also had the privilege, which was an amazing experience, to speak with one of OverCY's egg donors. So we actually spoke with her in their on-site studio, didn't we, Becky? That was an amazing experience to have. Highly recommend that one.
Yes, we did. I always love hearing different perspectives. And next episode, we're also going to be back speaking with the OverCY team all about different myths that might be involved in having treatment abroad and in Cyprus. So that's to come. But today we're focusing on a personal story, and it was an amazing conversation. I know Hayley had the tech gremlins when we were trying to record this a couple of days ago. So I'm recording this after we'd spoken to Sarah. But Hayley, you have listened back, and it's a long episode today. So, but I think you'll be engaged all the way through because it is such an amazing story. And I know how much it can help just to hear from other people with lived experience. And in particular, Sarah brought a few different things out through her story in relation to sperm donation, double donation, but also having that mixed family element as well.
Yeah, and it was great to listen back to, actually. And obviously the tech gremlins, I won't bore everyone with my dramas over the internet, but living in semi-rural Wales, I have the most unreliable internet. But yeah, that's a story for another day. But actually, listening to Becky talk with Sarah, it was great to actually have the time to listen back to that episode. And there is so many different conversations that you have, and it's such a rich podcast episode, actually. And it was, like I say, it's a really good one. And I was thinking of different titles to call it, and I think something along the lines of three conceptions but one family, I think, would be a great one. So yeah, we'll probably go with that, I think, as I'm talking now. But it really is, and it's such a great opportunity. And actually, Sarah reached out to us, didn't she, through our email, and just offered to share her story. And yeah, I'm really excited for you back home to have a little listen into that. So yeah, we'll introduce that shortly, won't we? That one now.
We will, yeah. So if anyone else is listening and you think, I'd love to share my story, we're always open to sharing stories, whether it's through Paths to Parenthood itself or through the podcast. Please do get in touch and do let us know your thoughts on this conversation. So I'm going to introduce now lovely Sarah, who is from Toronto in Canada. And we're going to be learning all about her story. She now has three children, not to give too many spoilers out, but in three very different ways. So I hope you enjoy it.
That's right. I'm from Toronto. I'm in Canada. And thank you so much for having me. I'm really thrilled to be able to talk to this community about my story, and hoping through storytelling that perhaps this resonates with somebody and helps them through a difficult time. Gosh knows, the path isn't always straightforward. It is a winding path, but the outcome in my case is totally worth it. So should I dive in?
Tell us your story. Yeah. So Sarah, what brought you to donor conception? I suppose it's a little bit before you got to donor conception that you need to tell in your own story.
Yeah. So my story goes back almost 13 years now, where my then I guess we could call him partner. He's now my husband, but he wasn't at the time. We wanted to start having kids. I was in my early 30s and he was just finishing up a PhD, and it felt like I was in a great place to do. I was one of those people that always knew they wanted kids. I remember I had this teddy bear when I was little, and I used to stick it under my shirt and look at myself pregnant and thought, oh gosh, this is really what I wanted. So it was very clear to me. And we started trying, and gosh, the months went by and negative, nothing happened. And about a year into this, we decided we probably need to go to a fertility clinic. And indeed we went. And gosh, my husband's sperm were low count, and there were motility issues and morphology. And they said literally to us, you have a 2% chance of conceiving naturally. No idea where the 2% came from. That number just seems so arbitrary to me, but anyhow, it had 2% chance. And so, of course, this was very disappointing and heavy news. And we went home to process it. I was quite upset, obviously. And in some strange thing happened, and that was 2 weeks later, I took a home pregnancy test and I was pregnant. Like, it was just wild. With a lot of arrogance and avoidance, we pretended like nothing ever happened. We were like, that fertility thing, no, that was just, they were wrong, we were right, yeah. It's fine. Went on to have a very uncomplicated pregnancy and birth and had this wonderful child and thought, hey, that was just weird. Everything's fine. And then a couple of years passed and we wanted to have another kid. And so we started trying again, and months passed with nothing. And we went back to the clinic. And this time was a bit different. I remember sitting in my office and getting a phone call from my husband. Knew something was up. His voice was wobbly. And he said they didn't find any sperm. And I didn't even know that was real. I knew that was possible, but I thought, wow, none? Not even one, none. And yeah, no, they didn't find any. They can retest, but there isn't any kind of thing. And I just remember like crumpling in a ball on the floor of my office, just thinking, oh my God, like, I don't even know how to process this. This is just unfathomable. So I packed up. I was no good at work anymore. Packed up and started walking and trying to process and figure out, what am I going to do? I really want another child. Maybe there's a mistake, and maybe there's something we can do. And halfway to my destination, it occurred to me, wait, people use sperm donors. And it just popped in my head. And without even talking to my husband, I made this decision and kind of said, okay, this is how we'll move forward. Now, of course, it's not that simple, and it wasn't that simple, but at least that I had this initial kind of idea about a new path we could take. But the story is a little bit more winding than that. And actually, I have written a bit of an essay, and I'm wondering if I could read an excerpt from it that describes the next step of the process. So I'm going to go ahead and read it, if you don't mind. It's called The Package. So finally, the date had arrived for my husband's biopsy and TESE surgery. My husband's left testicle was riddled with issues, varicocele nodules, epididymis, if I'm saying that right, and a pea-sized lump. We went to the hospital at that nauseating hour of the morning before the sun is up. Because the ultrasound revealed the possibility of cancer and the need for a biopsy and potential orchiectomy, the surgery was more complicated than normal, requiring a more painful incision and taking many hours. My close friend had just delivered a baby 2 days before by C-section and was staying in the same hospital. We met her in the lobby before the surgery and joked about how her and my husband would soon have matching scars. How cute! There was some levity to our interactions. A pit of anxiety lay in my stomach. Another dear friend came to meet me while my husband was in surgery, and we sat in the waiting room for what felt like days. I knew at some point I'd be asked to transport my husband's retrieved tissue to our fertility clinic in case there was sperm. And finally, I was called into the surgical area where a nurse abruptly dumped a package into my hands. Actually, it looked like someone's takeout lunch. A brown paper bag, and within it, a rectangular-shaped container, no larger than a typical takeout box from a nice restaurant. I don't know if my husband had lost his testicle, if I was indeed now transporting Lefty across the city. Was I really holding my husband's package in this package? You'd think they'd take more care in how they presented human tissue. I'm not suggesting bells and whistles or anything, but the brown paper bag seemed rather crude and unfitting for what this meant to us. Either way, I felt the gravity of the moment, so much so that despite its relative lightweight, this package felt enormously heavy to me. Heavy with the possibility of not having another child, heavy with the sadness that came with my husband's uncertain condition. It was as if my arms no longer worked properly and I had to double up my hands underneath to ensure I could carry it. I remember thinking one step, then another, good Sarah, now another, as if I was a child myself. As I finally made it to our fertility clinic and up to the 18th floor to drop off the package and all that it contained, tears began flooding into my eyes. I found it impossible to talk to the receptionist. How was I supposed to explain what I was carrying? I didn't even know what it was. Luckily, she was able to direct me to a lab technician who seemed to know what he was doing. As I followed him toward what looked like a lab, he began to open the package. I remember cringing at the thought of seeing what was in there. Fortunately, under the crude brown paper bag was a much more medical-looking container inscribed with my husband's identification. Sensing my fragility, perhaps due to his inherent sensitivity or to my heavily shaking hands, the lab technician offered me a hug. He was the first medical staff to do so that day. When I arrived back at the hospital, my husband was not even out of surgery. I looked at the clock and all but 20 minutes had elapsed. Finally, my husband's surgeon came in and looked and took me into the room. You know, that little room inside the waiting room that you get taken into when a doctor has something probably not so good to tell you? We went into that room. And as soon as the words, "the good news is," came out of his mouth, I knew we were out of luck. My husband didn't have cancer, which of course I was extremely grateful to know. But were we having another child together? The immediate answer was no. That would change over time as our definition for having a child together evolved. But at that moment, our journey was over. The doctor had not found any sperm, despite checking both sides, and worse, his testicles were a mess. We didn't know why it happened. There was scar tissue, excess veins that had destroyed one side and invaded the other. Lefty was the epicenter, and over time had taken down righty too. The doctor reassured me that my husband's health was fine. We didn't need to worry, but he really didn't have any sperm. And while the lab would take a finer grain look, we were likely out of luck. I remember saying, "So does this mean we need a sperm donor?" I distinctly remember the doctor nodding empathetically. That was December 13, 2016, and the start of our next incredible journey, becoming parents to donor-conceived children.
So, just before you move on there, Sarah, that was just the way you described that. It was almost like I was there with you. So thank you so much for sharing that, because I think it shows how everything can change in such a small space of time. And yet your brain can fast forward and think, we might be able to use donation, but there's still the grieving of what is lost to consider as well. So how did you get your heads around that and have those conversations to move forward with using a sperm donor?
Well, that's a great question and a great way to put it, actually. So one of the things that we did right around this time was to get a therapist that specialized in fertility and who could help us shape some of these conversations. The interesting outcome of all of this was that when they took a finer grain look, they found essentially what they call like baby sperm. And we actually moved forward with the idea that might work. And that was confusing and unfortunate. And in fact, it would have been better for us to have just started fresh and really processed what was happening. But it was like, and you said this, we were in two different realities. We're going to use a donor. And no, we can use my husband's sperm. So that was that duality was hard to hold. And in fact, our protocol was what's called a donor backup protocol, where we tried to use my husband's baby sperm, let's call it, and they split the eggs retrieved.
Yeah.
My husband got a certain amount and then the donor got the other amount. And so after you do IVF, and most people know about that, you get that first day, you know, the call from the lab and how many eggs you got in, et cetera. And then by day five or six, they're transferring an embryo if you get one. So on day one, I still thought my husband might be able to fertilize my eggs. And by day five, I was implanting a embryo using donor sperm. So that's how quickly it went from one path, one reality to the other. Yeah. And luckily, I was already having a lot of the conversations and thought and working with the therapist and talking with my husband. And obviously, we had picked out donor sperm. So it wasn't a total shock, but 5 days is a quick turnaround.
That hope stays with you, doesn't it, as well?
It does.
And you think, maybe I won't need to worry about that. And this will be our path, especially, I think, given what you were told the first time round, and then it worked and
exactly
you fell pregnant. So how did it go when you were choosing the donor sperm? Because I imagine you were choosing it, not actually knowing whether you were going to actually use the sperm as well. So I imagine it's a very strange situation to be in when you're still trying with your husband's sperm, but knowing that you need to pick your donor sperm at the same time. I don't want to use the word backup because it was sometimes suggested that, like, it's plan B. And lots of people say, well, I don't want my child to feel like they're plan B. And it is just the route rather than the destination of where you end up. But I do think it must have been a strange situation while she was still got that hope there, whilst also looking at the other option.
Yeah, and thank you for speaking about the language. I agree. I guess donor backup is a technical protocol term. And I actually would never, that's not how I would think of it, because of course, eventually I did have a child that I love dearly, that I would, of course, and hopefully will listen to this one day, know that it wasn't, it was just a different path.
When you were in that position where you were still hoping that your husband's baby sperm was going to work, but also at the same time, choosing a sperm donor, how did that work? Like, how did you select your donor? What type of donor did you use? What sort of thoughts were going through your head at that point?
Yeah, that's a great question. I had been working with a fertility therapist specializing in fertility, and so I was very familiar with the benefits of OpenID and picking a donor that my child one day could get, certainly get more information about, if not connect with. And so that was important to me. So I knew that, but that was very conceptual, right? That wasn't an emotional thing. That was conceptual. And there were certain values that I wanted to pick somebody that it seemed like they really wanted to make this donation for altruistic reasons. I was interested in their education, what they had chosen to do with their life, and so types of things. But I really struggled with picking a donor. Am I supposed to be attracted to this person as if they're like my husband, or am I picking the child that I want? I found it very confusing. And I didn't really know which way to go about it. And I actually didn't. You can pay for all sorts of extra things like pictures and that. And I probably should have paid for it for the sake of my child. But at the time, I actually didn't want that extra stuff. Yeah. That felt too much. And it almost didn't matter. Health mattered. Education mattered. Like, there were some really important things. OpenID. And then other than that, I should say that in Canada, there is some donor sperm, but it's few and far between, and they cannot be compensated for it. And so our availability is there's not a lot because of this reason. Yeah. And so most Canadians actually use American sperm banks. And so that adds a whole other layer of complexity, because you're trusting in the institutions from another country that they're providing you accurate information. And this was back in 2000. It would have been 16, 17. And so things were a bit different in terms of the knowledge that we had, in terms of like what are the rules around how many families can be created? And so it was a bit more like the Wild West, I felt. And so I do think, given that we have more information now, I think that perhaps the process would have been different, but it was what it was. And I loved I mean, the end product is perfect. So everything I did to get there worked, right? It could have been easier with more information.
Yeah. I think I resonate with that as well. So I was around 2015 when we were going through it, and there was just nobody really talking about it. There was no information out there. And yes, there was counseling, which I know years and years ago, there wasn't even that level of support. But it is such an unusual situation to find yourself in, and to think, okay, I'm going to have to choose the future genetics for my future child, but without really knowing, like you say, from a different country, how things work, and obviously what's come to light with family limits nowadays. And I know Hayley resonates with that as well from her own situation. Okay. So there's a lot that you have to take on board and think about, but I always say the same. Like, we used an anonymous donor from the Czech Republic, and knowing what I know now, I would go OpenID straight away, but I wouldn't change our girls, because that's what led me to them. And I think it is one of those things, you do the best you can do with the information you have at the time. And I think once you have that child, it's very hard to regret that, because it led you to them. But we've given the outcome of this straight away. Did it work on that first attempt with the sperm donor, or did you have to have several attempts?
So we got three embryos. So none of the eggs that were tried to be fertilized by my husband were fertilized. So it was 0 out of 6. And then all three with the donor fertilized, which was great, but also very, very obvious what our situation was. It was very clear that it wasn't going to work with my husband. So in a way that was good, right? If one had worked and then it didn't, it was definitive.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so I tried the first embryo and it didn't work. It was devastating. It was like going through everything all over again. I tried the second and it didn't work. And I just thought, this is like hell on wheels. What is going on here? And I should say they were all graded really well, of course, and all that. This was before PGA, I think it is, testing was really used widespread way. So I didn't test any of them. But so it was pretty devastating. We ended up going away on a trip out east to visit friends and had a lovely time and came back a little bit more relaxed and to try the third and last embryo. And it's actually a funny story because the day I was going to find out if it had worked, I decided not to do home testing. That was leading me down a terrible rabbit hole. And I thought, no, I'm just going to wait for that phone call.
Yeah.
But it was also the first day of my son's starting kindergarten. It was his first day of kindergarten. And they, at our clinic, they want you to come in first thing in the morning, typically to test. And I thought it was more important to me to go to school on this first day with my son. So I went in late that day. And because I went in late, it messed up their system of phoning people back and they forgot to call me. And so I spent the whole day waiting for this phone call and it never came. And at the end of the day, I called in an attempt to figure out what was going on and it went to answering machines and they had switched to their next shift or whatever it was, emergency only kind of thing. And I thought, oh my God, I'm not going to know with certainty. Do I go to the drugstore, test myself? What do I do? And again, it's another example of I packed up at work and marched out the door because there was no good at work anymore. And I just started walking. And luckily, I got a phone call halfway to where I was going. And the whole, hi, Sarah, is this a good time to talk? And I just, that triggers me when somebody says that to this day.
Me as well.
Like, yes, but I know it's bad news. I remember saying this to her. I know it's bad news. Nobody called me. Like, I know. And she said, it's not bad news, but I'm actually not the one who's supposed to be telling you this. And I thought, what is going on? And she said, no, you tested the beta. It was positive. And the numbers are really good. And yes, you're indeed pregnant. And I thought, oh my God, thank goodness. And the joy and relief that I felt at that moment is almost indescribable, but it was magic.
I can almost picture you in this, getting that news and people around you looking at you thinking, what is going on here? But it must have been an amazing.
Oh, yeah. I was in the middle of the sidewalk. It was,
in the middle of the street.
Yeah.
And how was your husband at that time? Because obviously he's been through a process himself as well of grieving at the loss of his genetics and getting his head around that. How was that for him as well?
Yeah. I mean, he spent a lot of time worrying about me and me being happy. And that was great. Like, his care of me is what makes me love him so much. But in caring for me so much, I'm not sure how much he always processed everything in the moment. But he did see the therapist with me and he was processing and he's the type of person who can very easily adapt. So I knew that this was capable, but it happened in bits and pieces across time. His sister is adopted. So and of course, adoption and donor conception are not the same, but there is an understanding around not being genetically related to someone that you grew up with and in your family. And so from that perspective, he was already comfortable. He never suffered. For him, it was never tied up in masculinity or anything like that. There was always concern or question around, why did this happen? Because this is such a bizarre thing. And that was we've never known why it happened. So I think he moved forward with the knowledge that I was so happy and that we were building a family. And then it actually became more real and more solidified when he got to meet our son and our child and go, oh, of course, this is my child and the genetics don't matter. And it really started to just come to place. But his open-mindedness from the beginning was really served us well. And I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah. And I think that's amazing to hear that kind of relationship where it sounds like you were open with each other. You talked about this. And when you said there, once your baby arrived and he met that baby, that everything was like, oh, yes, this is how it's meant to be. And I was just talking recently about that whole concept is very different to the reality. And it's being able to get from the concept of using a donor through to the reality of actually having that child can make such a difference. And I want to ask you a little bit more about that whole mixed family of genetics and your conversations. But first, let's get to the end of your family building story. Let's hear what happened next, because it is fascinating the way that your story has developed over time.
I agree, and it's my own life. But so we had this wonderful child, a beautiful birth. I was able to have him at home, surrounded by my family, and wonderful, just been such a delightful child. But gosh, I'm greedy, I gotta say, and I wanted another one. I turned 40 and I thought, I'm not done. I really want another kid. And I knew how hard it was for us to have kids, and I was willing to go there. I thought, you know what, I know it's hard, but this is really important to me. And so just after my 40th birthday, I went back to the clinic and I said, what do we need to do to get there? And I signed up for, in Canada, you can get one round of IVF covered by government insurance if you're under age 43. And so I signed up to get this covered round, and everything was looking good. Then COVID happened and everything shut down and timelines moved around. And eventually when things opened up a little bit, I did my round of IVF. And it was a terrible round of IVF. I think I had one egg that fertilized, and it never made it to blastocyst. So it was awful. It was really disappointing. And
sorry to interrupt. Yeah. So was this with the same sperm donor that you used?
Oh, that's a great question. No, it wasn't, because the donor we had used, I guess, retired or stopped. Yeah. There was none left. And I actually called the sperm bank and I talked to them about what our options were. And apparently there is always this option where you can reach out privately to a donor and try to do a private donation. That felt weird, complicated. Mm-hmm. It didn't sit with me. And so I decided that, you know what, listen, my two sons, older and younger at that point, they're brothers. They're genetically related, but they're brothers. And this, what am I trying to say? I guess I didn't feel the need. I guess I didn't feel like there had to be another genetic connection between the kids. That it, certainly with my kid I already had, he had a genetic relationship with me and his brother, and that maybe they didn't need to be connected. And that, actually, I'm rambling now. I'm not quite sure how to explain my feeling of it, but I decided not to spend a lot of time and effort trying to hunt down this kind of unicorn and just move on, basically. And so we picked a different donor, but we ended up picking multiple donors because this phase went on and on. And after COVID, sperm was really hard to find, at least at the clinics that we were working with, or the sperm banks we were working with. So I might have found something I liked and then it might have been gone and I had to pick another. So it was many different donors over that period of time. And I was okay with that. It didn't really bug me too much. So that first round of IVF was disastrous. Saw a naturopath. I made some lifestyle changes. Had the daily smoothies.
Yeah.
All the things naturopaths suggest. And for whatever reason, and I don't believe it was entirely the lifestyle stuff, but for whatever reason, the next round of IVF went much better and I was able to fertilize more eggs and I made an embryo. And the embryo was rated really well and we did the PGA testing and it actually came back indeterminate, but my fertility doctor said, let's not worry about it. It's rated well. Often when it's indeterminate, it means that it's fine. Let's go forward with it. And I thought, great, okay. Did the transfer. I had my, and it was a positive test, which was fantastic. I thought, oh my God, this is going to happen. I was expecting so much more trial. And here we are. I went for the first ultrasound and we detected a heartbeat, which was great, but it was a little slow. And after that first ultrasound, I started feeling just a little off. I had a lot of anxiety. Something just felt wrong. And I had another ultrasound about 3 weeks later. And unfortunately, the baby had stopped growing about a day after they thought that ultrasound. Amazingly enough, my feelings of something being wrong were actually rooted in something being wrong. And it was devastating. It was really devastating. And this is even after I'm coming from a privileged position of having two beautiful, healthy kids, and I was still just broken by it. So I cannot imagine when Somebody goes through this in their first attempt without having children to at least go and cuddle after. So it's hard stuff. I don't wish it on anyone. So that was really difficult. And given my age, and at this point I was 42, I thought, this is it, right? I'm not going to have this next child that I want. But I'm stubborn and I didn't give up. I went back after taking a little bit of a break. I went back to the doctor, fertility doctor, and he suggested doing a bunch of IUIs with like lots of fertility medication, making lots of eggs and just going for it. And this is where all the different donors came in, because I need a new sperm each time. And we tried that route. It was less invasive than IVF and cheaper. And given my age, I didn't have a great chance either way. So we just thought like, maybe we'll find the egg, right? You're on a hunt for that just one out of a million egg. And that didn't work. My doctor at that point said, this feels like the end of the road, right? And I knew that conversation was going to happen at some point. I knew he had enough ethics to not perpetuate this on and on forever. I suppose I could have switched clinics and tried harder. I still was making follicles. So I could have gone on and on, but I was 44 at this point, and I knew there was some limit in, I felt, in how aged I was going to become before this would happen. And did I continue? Did I want to just do this ad nauseum? And so I think it was great that he said, maybe this is the end of the road. But being a parent of a donor conceived child, I knew that there was a different path. And so I said, what about egg donation? And he said, great, go talk to blah, 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 and we can do it. And so I very quickly went on this new path. Now, I must say, initially, it was very logistical. I was, okay, I'm going to find the egg. I'm going to make the appointment. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to call back that naturopath, do this. And it was just checklists and logistics. And I just marched along the way. And I wasn't having the big feelings around it yet. I was just getting stuff done. I ended up having, my clinic told me that in their experience, frozen eggs were less likely to work than fresh. And so they recommended, and I don't know if this is true across the board, but this is just advice. So they recommended using a clinic again in the US, because in Canada, I'm actually not sure even what the rules are currently in Canada, but I don't think we have any egg donors in Canada, or very few. We'd have to fact check that. But so anyway, it was an American bank that we went to. And now the kind of the problem with the fresh approach was that the model for fresh eggs, at least at this clinic that they recommended, was anonymous. It was going to be an anonymous donor. Mm-hmm. And the wait for it not to be anonymous was they needed to recruit the person, screen the person, do the get a lawyer. It was just this long, complicated path. And I see a lot of importance in the path. In the moment I was at that time, that moment in time, having been the age I was, having gone through everything I'd gone through, I couldn't bear the complexity of it. And I knew that I would pick a donor that was open ID, a sperm donor that was open ID. And I just believed that I could explain to my kid why I did this. Now, looking back, and it's not that long, but was that the right choice? I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. I know I have a lot of work to do to make up for it, so to speak, in terms of helping my kid understand. I'm not sure I could have done the other thing in that moment. And maybe it was selfish for me to just push forward on my desire to have this child. I'm not sure. I have to figure that out. Actually, that's some work that I'll have to do.
I think this is often a difficult thing that we wrestle with afterwards, don't we? We think, why decision and why did I do that? And actually, I think the way you've just explained it there, and say your child is listening back in the future, you are sharing very honest, human, vulnerable thoughts and circumstances that you were in at that time. And so I completely empathize having this anonymous donor, but I do feel as well that obviously DNA testing is much more prevalent nowadays, that it isn't an impossibility, but as parents we obviously have to manage those expectations and be there to support them whatever they want to do. But just so when you'd found your egg donor, you got your sperm donor. How did that, was that smooth from that point onwards? Did you conceive the first time with double donation, or was that another tricky route for you?
Yeah, nothing in my experience is easy. So it wasn't at all straightforward. Just the logistics were even complicated. They had to get the sperm and bring it to the clinic where the egg, like the double donation is like, you're organizing two different things to happen to bring it together. So all of that was back and forth with the agency I was working with. And then hearing back about how the cycle went and how many embryos I got. And luckily I got four and they all looked really good. But all of this was happening. And then I tried the first embryo and it didn't work. I tried the second embryo and it didn't work. So here I am, like in the same kind of thing is happening as it did before. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, like I did all this and I thought this was going to be a sure win here. And what is happening? So I go and do more tests and I did that. There's the three tests. One looks at your microbiome. One looks at if you have any kind of infection, bacterial infection, and the other kind of looks at receptivity of your uterus. So I did the three and they take a biopsy and they do it. And of course, this slows you down. You have to take a whole other cycle to do it. It's more money. But they did discover that my receptivity, maybe I should do it a day later. Now, I should say I'm a researcher and I did look into the research and the research isn't actually really strong for this test. It's quite strong in terms of the microbiome and the bacteria part, but this receptivity piece is less, the evidence is not as strong in favor of doing this test and what and how to interpret this test. So here I am as a researcher who wants to make evidence-based decision, making a decision that actually wasn't necessarily evidence-based.
Once it goes out of the window, I think sometimes when you're trying to conceive.
So they said, put it in a day later. And I said, fine, put it in a day later. And hey, it worked. Maybe it was the embryo, who knows, but it worked. And you know, that phone call, gosh, I remember the phone call like it was yesterday and just the joy of hearing it. And my son, my oldest son, who was 11 at the time, heard some reaction. And he was worried, what's going on? Are you okay? What's happening? And I didn't want to tell him quite yet. And I told him everything was fine. I'm healthy and everything is fine. And I'm going to let you know what just happened in a little bit, but you just have to wait. But I promise you everything's fine. And he said, okay. And I remember going back and telling him when I was pregnant months later and telling him, remember that phone call? That was when I found out and it all made sense to him. And so I was pregnant and I was just so over the moon and happy. And it was about maybe a month into it or 6 weeks when I started kind of processing some of the more emotional stuff around it. And none of it was bad, but stuff I hadn't let myself go to yet. I'm like, oh, wait, this is a baby that's not genetically related to me. Oh, okay, interesting. That's new. Oh, this baby is not going to look like me necessarily. Oh, that's a new feeling. Oh, what are people going to think of having this other child? I'm 45 years old. What? And so I got flooded with a lot of the emotions when I was pregnant.
It's like it came at you probably a bit later. You were so in the practical side of how do I get pregnant and how do I bring home this baby? And then suddenly, I think pregnancy is a time where you often really start to feel those things and think, because it feels more real. It's not that concept anymore. And I remember a lot of the fears I had almost really ramping up during pregnancy.
Yes.
So, absolutely. So how did you deal with those? How did you get your head around things throughout that pregnancy?
So, that's a great question. Again, I still was with the therapist that I had started with many years ago. And I understood, and she supported this very much around have the feelings, feel the feelings, let the feelings come out. And what I've learned through my experience is that feelings change. And so you can feel panicked in a moment and feel perfectly at peace a moment down the line. So you just let them out, look in the dark corners and feel the things, and then they're not so scary. And I remember one of the things was around bonding. Would I bond with this child the way I had with my others? I had two other examples of how to bond. Would that happen? So that was there. But I remember I was probably starting my third trimester, and I remember I was waiting for a streetcar, and I remembered, oh, I haven't felt the baby kick for a little bit. Gosh, what's going on? And I that feeling when you're like, okay, I'm just going to really concentrate now, and then nothing happens. And then time feels like it's like slowing down, and you're like, why is the baby not kicking? And I'm like prodding at my stomach, and I'm like, oh my gosh, what's going on? And then the baby kicks, and it's perfectly fine. He kicked again. And it was like, but what that taught me is, oh gosh, I love this baby so much. And I am bonded to this baby. I'm questioning whether I'm going to bond. I am bonded. We're already here. Like there's no question about it. And so that was a really great moment. It really tested some of my fears in real life. And so that kind of took some weight off, definitely. Yeah.
Did you ever speak to your husband about how he felt about bonding, obviously, without genetics? I wonder whether that dynamic came up, because obviously you had seen that genetics weren't required for them to bond with your second child. How did that come into your mind at all? Did you have conversations around that?
We did talk to him about it, and he explained that it's not going to matter. Like, you're not, that it's, there are these feelings, and you go through different stages of thinking about it, but it doesn't matter. But I think more than our conversations that we had was simply the modeling in our household, like just the father he was to our second child, our first, but our second child, like there was no difference. There was really nothing was different between the two, the cuddling, the loving, the care for, but even the sternness, the doubt, it's not, everything was the same. And so through the modeling of that parenting, I knew it innately that, oh, it is going to be like that. Like I'm going to be like he is with our kids. So watching him be a father set the tone for how it was going to feel, more than any conversation. But of course, the conversations are important and great too. And we were able to be very open with each other. But I was lucky in the sense that I had this insight on how it might be, this very intimate insight. And maybe that helped pave the way a little bit.
And so you now have three children. So yes. What ages are your children now? We're recording, obviously, 2026.
Yes. Okay. So I have a 12-year-old. I have a 7-year-old, and I have a almost 6-month-year-old.
Amazing.
Yeah, and all three are boys. Really big age differences, but I'm finding that to be lots of fun. And but at the same time, what they need from me is quite different. And so when it comes to conversations about all of this, we're at very different places and how.
How have you, obviously your eldest is 12 and fully genetically related to both of you.
Yes.
And that is a different story to your second child who you can see with a sperm donor. How have you managed those conversations? And this is a question I hear so much from people who are maybe considering using a donor for a second child or a sibling. And from those who are maybe in those early days thinking, okay, how do I explain these two different stories to do two different children as part of the same family? Because it's part of your family story, isn't it? But both have their own unique story as well.
Yeah, it's a great question, because not only is everyone conceived kind of slightly differently, everyone's at a different level of understanding that conception too. So I guess I follow the advice of tell early and often. And so I try to integrate a little bit about the donor and of my middle son whenever it feels authentic and appropriate to do. And it's directed at my middle son, but often my older son is there. And so I want him to clue into the conversation too. But it's not like I'm really talking to my middle son with the ears open of my older son a lot. And so we were going to France as part of a trip we were taking, and my middle son's donor had French ethnicity. And I mentioned this. I said, what's going to be really cool? We're going to go to France, and this is where your donor's from. And at that time, my middle son was not old enough to get much out of that. But my older son said, oh, that's cool. Oh, I love, because he's really into soccer, about something about the French soccer team. And oh, that's really cool. And that's how the story is being told, is through those real conversations in real time and their reactions to it. And just the other day, my oldest son, just out of the blue, he goes, wait, so does that mean I'm the only one that's genetically related to both of you? And I was like, yeah. He's, oh, okay, yeah, cool. It was like he it just clued into him. And that's actually, in a way, it was a good thing, because it's like, it wasn't this huge monolithic thing that was just taking over everyone's lives and thoughts. It was just more, oh, okay, just a fact of how we are. And I'm a bit different because I'm genetically related to both, but that's not better or worse than anybody else in this family. Yeah. It was so neutral, his reaction to it.
Yeah, and that's often something that I hear worries from parents when they think, I don't want one child to feel less than because they don't share genetics. And that's a really lovely way of you explaining that actually he's pieced that together and he doesn't see it as, oh, yeah, I've got more than you. It's just, that's different. And it is amazing how children can take on these different stories. And has your 7-year-old asked a lot about the sperm donor, or does it come up often? How often do you tend to talk about the story?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure. We go through periods of time where it comes up more and then less, just depending. I like it to come into natural conversation as opposed to sitting him down and saying, oh, let's talk about the donor. So far, he's pretty uninterested, which I understand is typical for his age group. We had a conversation about body types. And so we were saying, which my older son, your chest looks like dad's and your legs are more like mom. And then with my 7-year-old, I said, I don't know where your body type is like, maybe from your grandmother, but I suspect it's probably from your donor. And he said, oh, okay, yeah, that must be because it does look a bit different than you and daddy. So that must be where it's from. And these kind of natural ways, and it's always quite neutral, right? Or some pride attached to it. And, oh, I do look this way. And that's great. Yeah. And so it comes. Yeah, I would say that one of my fears was that it would be monolithic, that it would take up so much of my thought and my parenting and our life, but it isn't. It's there. It's an important piece, absolutely. But in the day-to-day lives of raising children and just living life in this complicated age, it's just one of many things. And while I want to honor it, the fear of it taking over isn't at all founded. And I think that the kind of the natural coming in and out of conversation and interest and, oh, remember that book that we used to read about the sperm donor mom? Can we read it again? Sure, let's go up and get it. Just, I guess sometimes I worry, do I bring it up enough? Because I know I need to take lead on it because of his age. And then I'll bring it up more perhaps. But I think he's satisfied at this age with where we're at. I have to be mindful of his developmental needs, of course. But yeah.
Definitely. And it sounds, I can really relate to that. There's been times where I think, gosh, we've not mentioned it in a long while and I need to reinforce it. And you then bring it up and they look at you like, yeah, I know. Like, why are you talking about this again? It's all about being age appropriate. And I love the way you talked about how you very naturally talked about what was a difference in body shape, but just in a really, like you say, neutral way, not putting, like saying, like, it's just allowing him to understand what that genetic connection does mean. So that might mean you look slightly different or you might get that trait from the donor. And I've also used those similar opportunities and conversations to say, oh, I wonder. And it is that wondering with them that I think is really important, as well as telling them about their story. There's that wondering and, oh, I wonder if, and I think that then gives them permission to wonder as well. And I think that's something that as parents, from all of the conversations I've had with child psychologists and over time, that can be a really important signal that you're open to them having their own thoughts and you can be spoken to at any time. So it sounds like you're doing a great job. And then obviously you've got a 6-month-old at the moment. Yeah. Your little one obviously won't be able to understand just yet, but have you thought about how you might introduce that story? And actually, have you talked about the egg and sperm donor with your older children as well?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so right away when I told my kids I was pregnant, and we told them my older one first, and I went off with him and explained right from the beginning. I said how we used a donor to make Addie a sperm donor, and I know that. And I said, okay, so we used a sperm donor again. Okay. And I said, and you know how mommy was trying and using a lot of medication to get pregnant for a long time, and I couldn't use my own eggs. And so we were able to use a donor for my egg too. And I said, oh, okay. That was it. Okay. Now it's come up again because my I feel like especially my older one, he forgets about the egg part of it because he's so used to the model of the sperm. So we have to mention, and I think it's just a new model he has to make of what that really means. And I think also because I carried the pregnancy, that part, you're the mummy, and it's, yeah, of course I'm the mummy. There's a bit more nuance there. I'm not sure, but we'll have to keep on coming back to it. I have a lot of, I have a kind of a mantra that I've been using, and I say I've made my kids with the brute force of my uterus, meaning that they each got shaped by me. And I'm very proud of, with my third child, he's not genetically related, but he grew inside me like my other kids. And epigenetics is such a fascinating field. Like I always think of, what are the ways that my body might have turned this on, turned this off? And so I have a lot of pride in the biological, not genetic, but biological connection that I have to this child. And I talk to my kids a lot about how that's one continuity, one sameness between all of them, is that they all grew out of me this way. And they all drank the breast milk, and that this is a connection. And so, yes, the brute force of my uterus is my way of helping them understand a little bit about that piece of it too. And it's interesting because my baby, my youngest, there is a family resemblance across all three boys. There just is.
Yeah.
I don't know why. And again, and people have mentioned it, and people who know that I used to date egg donor, I say back, the brute force. It's brute force of the uterus. And I think that was a bit tangential to where we're talking about, but I think it's an important piece and something that women who are, or people who are planning pregnancy using egg donation, should know that there is that piece. There is a biological connection that you can very well feel. And that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. We're actually going to be having a session on epigenetics and bonding in our upcoming virtual summit, which we've not announced yet, but I'm really excited to hear more about that. And I think it is something that is important to understand as well. And I think we often focus so much on the things that we couldn't do and the things we don't share, but actually also, like you said, that there's a lot that your boys do share, and they share the same nurturing environment and everything else that comes with that. I want to ask you a question, because you said when you were pregnant, you were worried about, would I bond in the same way?
Yes.
So how would you feel about kind of your relationship with all three of your boys?
Yeah, that's a great question. So with my third, when he popped out, I had this rush of joy and euphoric experience, exactly the same as with my other two. There was absolutely no difference, no detectable difference in the feelings I had and the extent that we bonded, the way we were together. Like if I could freeze that moment and send it out to anybody who's worried about this, I would, because I'm very privileged to have had the genetic connection too. I realize that, but it also gives me a comparison, and I can tell you it doesn't matter. It does not.
And that's so, I think, comforting for people to hear, because I know there is that worry, and I'm there. I always say I wish I could bottle the feeling I have
with
our girls, but I don't have a comparison, and I always say I can't imagine that I would feel any differently if I had a child that was genetically linked to me. But it is something, it's a very real fear, I think, that many people have and worry. And I also, I think one of the big things I've learned is that bonding isn't just that one moment. It happens over time. It's a process, and it's something that regardless of how you've conceived your baby, you are still meeting a little stranger, even whether it's your genetics or not. And I think the donor conception side of things almost just amplifies those feelings of, who's this little person, and how am I going to feel, and how are they going to feel? And you've actually got then a lifetime of getting to know each other, which is, I always think, is such a privilege. And it sounds like you're doing it in a really open environment. And I'd love to also know, you just alluded to, and I'm very conscious of time, I've been taking your time for an hour now, but it's a fascinating story. But you mentioned about being open with other people, and this is also another question that comes up a lot around how did you decide who to tell? What did you, were there people that you didn't tell? What reactions have you had? Because I suppose you started having to think about this with your second child when you used a sperm donor, and then obviously through to your third.
Yeah, this is a really important piece. I think about this in a three-tiered system. So There's the inner circle, and that's people that are important, have an important role in my kid's life. That's close family and close friends, and they need to know. In my opinion, they need to know because they need to be able to support my children, and so they need that this important information about how my children were made. So that's that kind of inner circle. And then I kind of go out to the next rung of that circle. And these are people that they don't need to know, but given a opportunity, I'm happy to tell. And what I mean by an opportunity is I feel safe, I have time, I have the wherewithal to have this conversation, because it's not a casual. For me, it isn't just, it's not to say this is the same for everyone, but for me, it feels weighted in with a lot of a big story. And so sometimes I feel like I want the time and space. I want to feel comfortable. So if I have that time, then that person shall know. But if it's in a busy restaurant and there's a table beside me here and something going on, it's probably not the moment that's going to happen. And it's not hiding it. It's not a secret. It's just that wasn't an opportunity. So that's that middle. And then there's that outer rung of essentially strangers. And mostly, I don't think strangers have to know. And that's simply because strangers don't know a lot of things about me. Are there cases where it may come up? Sure, maybe. And again, if there's an opportunity, it feels right, then it would. But typically, I don't feel like I need to tell strangers. Outside of a situation like this, where I'm very happy to tell the kind of anyone listening, but just in my day-to-day life, there's no need to announce it at the grocery store, I think.
I love how you wrote that down with that inner circle, the importance of having that support for your children, then basing it on the opportunity and whether or not you think it's the right time to tell that next ring, and then the strangers. And this is one I've done a bit of a trial and error type thing, where occasionally if someone's made a comment about resemblance or something, or where do they get the curls from, there's always the traditional hairdresser question when we take them to the hairdressers. And it's those moments where I've gone, oh, you never guess, blah, 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 and I've told the whole story and then come away thinking, oh, felt a bit too much. Did I need to do that? But then also I felt like I was modelling it for the girls. But then there's been other times where then I haven't really said, I've just said, oh, yeah, they're beautiful, aren't they, and moved on, and then thought, oh, should I have said something there?
Yes.
So I think I'm always in that moment of, I'm a very open person, I wear my heart, and I've just always feel like I'm never quite sure whether it's the right thing. But I think you saying that in that moment, does it feel right? Is it the right thing to do? I think it's so important, the context of the moment as well as the person. So yeah, I think that will really help people to maybe think about this. And you also made the point there around you're not being secretive about it by not telling somebody. You are entitled to privacy. And like you say, it's a story that needs honouring with the time and the context and the right opportunity to share that story as well. But just in terms of your wider family, have they been supportive? Have you ever had anyone with any negativity around your story at all? Or I think often this is a fear that many people have as well.
Yeah, I was fearful. And luckily, I haven't had any negativity at all. And even from people I thought, family members, I thought, oh, maybe they would be judgmental or have something to say about it. That's not, at least nobody has told me anything to my face. I've been very lucky. There was another narrative that I had been worried about, was the combination of what would people think about the donor and also my age at having a child at 45. And so both of those created kind of this worry of judgment that actually has been completely unfounded. And I can tell you that not a single person has commented or thought strangely about my age and my decision, and I've received support. Now, that may be in part because I've differentiated between these rungs in a way that made sense for my life. But I also think that in general, our worst fears about judgment are just not. I think there's some people out there that have some problems, and for sure they exist, right? But I think most people, they're either supportive or just don't care. And so I think that's really important to remember, that in most cases it'll be neutral, if not positive, the reaction. And
That's very much what I found as well. I think often we fear the worst and we imagine how people, I think it's not just about this, but in general in life, you think, oh, they're thinking that about me. And actually a lot of the time people are wrapped up in what's going on in their own lives as well. And
absolutely,
this is like the main thing for you. It's probably not going to be for them. So hopefully that will reassure people who are listening as well. Sarah, I can't thank you enough. I feel like we've covered so much in this episode. And I just want to say a massive thank you for being so open and for coming forward and offering to share your story, because like I say, it is a very unique story. You never know, there might be someone out there whose story is identical to yours, but there will be so many people out there who will share different elements of your story, whether it be double donation, mixed family, sperm donation, all of these different things that you have shared with us, I know will be so helpful. So thank you. Is there anything you would like to share before we wrap up this conversation?
Thank you so much for listening to me and giving me the platform to tell my story. I wanted to say that. But I also think it's so important to find your people as you're going through a process like this. Is you need people that kind of get what's going on. And I think this is a way through storytelling that you can find your people. And honestly, yes, I would say I'm thrilled to be someone's person for a moment if I can, and support them along this journey. I would just add that the outcome of having these children really overshadows any difficulty experience along the way. And it can seem like a daunting path. It's actually a gift to have taken this path and learned what I've learned and to welcome these just amazing creatures that I just adore and love into the world. I guess I'll end it on that positive note.
It's a beautiful note to end this conversation. Thank you so much, Sarah. I really appreciate it. And I know that we will have many people who will probably get in touch after this. Is there anywhere where people can reach you, or if they come via me, I can always put them in contact with you, can't I, Sarah, if you're happy for me to do that?
Absolutely. Or you can share my email address. I'm happy to, be in contact if that helps. Absolutely. Great.
Thank you. So if this has resonated with you and you'd love to reach out to Sarah, do let me know. And if you obviously want to find your people, we've got lots of community available in Paths to Parent Hub, and it is a really safe space to be able to explore how you're feeling at all of these different stages that we've talked about today. So we've been talking for just over an hour, and it just doesn't do it justice when it's such a long journey that you've been through. But I think what you've really been able to do is paint that picture of where you started to where you are now. And I know that there'll be people maybe in their car, going for a walk, listening to this, and would have found comfort in your words. So thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do take a moment to rate and review wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't forget our free resources, including our recent webinar, Why Telling Matters, our friends and family resource, and lots more via our website.
So do come and join us in the Paths to Parenthood membership. We'd love to see you there.
Until next time.